Morning. I'm Pastor Matthew. I'm one of the pastors here at Brandywine, and I am excited to dive into the book of Ruth with you today. But would you pray with me as we give this time to God? Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for this book and all that we've been learning from it over the weeks that have gone by and the weeks to come. And I ask that you would guide our time today, that we would be able to worship you as we study your word, that we would continue to worship you as we sing and as we give our offerings and as we fellowship with one another. God, we ask that this time would be all about you, that you would help us to focus, that you would settle our minds, that you'd free us from the distractions of the week and home and work and all and school and all of those other places, and let us give this time fully to you for your glory. In your name, amen. We are in the third week of our study through the book of Ruth. And I got to be honest, I'm excited about it because this is one of my favorite books of the Bible. It's such an incredible and powerful story in just a few pages. So much incredible weight in there. In 1320, Dante Alighieri wrote in the Divine Comedy that Ruth was, quote, the gleaner-made meek ancestress of David the psalmist. And David was defining Ruth the way many do, as this simple, quiet, meek woman who would glean and like to pose for photos and paintings and fields of wheat. Seems like that's all you ever see of her. And it almost comes across as though it's some sort of romantic Disney fairy tale. But it was not. There is so much more there than our westernized 2021 eyes tend to see. And it is a love story, but it's a story of love far deeper and greater than anything that we see in movies and stories today. And like Rihanna's song, we find love in a hopeless place today. Ruth was written 3,000 years ago, during a time when women were treated like property. First of their fathers, then of their husbands. They couldn't own land. They didn't go to school. They couldn't have a say in the community. They weren't even considered trustworthy enough to speak as a witness in trials. And the role was so low. This story, though, stood out so much that we have a book of the Bible named after a woman. And not just any woman, a foreign woman. Let that sink in. That should grab our attention. There's something going on here that is significant. It's so impactful that Jewish synagogues read it out loud every year during the Feast of Weeks to celebrate this story and the lessons in it. Ruth was not some meek, quiet ancestress of David. She was a woman who was assertive, who took the lead. And in a culture where she would have been treated like property, she stood out as someone who was listened to and followed, despite her gender, her ethnicity, and her place at the bottom of the economic ladder. Ruth is a story of love. It is a beautifully written exploration of hesed, an ancient Hebrew word that describes kindness, graciousness, and loyalty that goes beyond the call of duty. Many describe it as simply loving kindness. We've seen it over the last couple weeks. In chapter 1, it records Naomi's hesed, her loving kindness to Ruth and Orpah when she says, just go back home. After all of their husbands have died, she's like, go back to your family and start over. Life with me will be too hard, too much. Just go back there. She was willing to release her hold on them. Ruth demonstrated hesed when she said, no, I'm staying with you. Her powerful words, where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. She gives up everything to continue to care for and protect this woman, to continue to look out for this family line of men who are now dead. Chapter 2 details even more hesed. First, in Ruth's initiative in stepping out to glean, which, if you recall, was a practice set up back in the day. It was a way for those who were too poor or didn't have a job or whatever to still be able to care for themselves. And so gleaning It was required of landowners that they would leave the corners of their field untouched, that as their harvesters went through the field, they would have two packs of harvesters. First, the men would go through and chop down all of the field, all of the grain, all of whatever it was, and they would leave it on the ground. And then a second group of workers She basically said, can I go with the second group of women and just pick up the stuff your men chopped down, right? Not pick up the leftovers. She just wants to go ahead and straight up harvest the field. And she is stepping, this is a risky move for a foreign, poor woman with no standing in this community. Any other landowner would have said, get off my property. This is presumptuous. This is offensive. This is ridiculous. But Boaz showed chesed as well. Boaz went farther than was required. Boaz, in that moment, remembered the law said to allow for the poor to be able to glean, but the spirit of the law was so that the hungry could eat. And so Boaz says, yeah, do it. And he tells his men to protect her. And he even gives her a great deal of extra food that first day, because Ruth would have gleaned all day, but then it would have taken hours to turn that into something you could eat. And so he gives her prepared food. The sheer amount of food he gave to her and Naomi was the equivalent of 2 weeks' wages that the other men in the field would have earned. And so she went home with this overwhelming amount of food, able to feed, able to start, because his chesed understood the spirit is so much more than what the law requires. And so he went beyond. And he says to her, when Ruth is mystified at why he's being so generous with her, a stranger, Boaz says to her in chapter 2, verse 12, may the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Boaz is blown away by her chesed, her heart, her devotion to Naomi. It's actually kind of a rebuke to the rest of the community that they should have been rising to take care of this widow that was their family, part of their community, their people, and yet a foreign woman was doing more for Naomi than anyone else there. And Boaz is moved by her reputation, what people are saying about this Ruth and what she is doing. And so he says this to her, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Spoiler alert, this prayer is going to come back into play in today's passage, but I'm getting ahead of myself. The second chapter ends with Naomi's observation that Boaz was their guardian redeemer. A what? We'll get into that in a few minutes. But here's the important thing, is it's a note of hope. The author of Ruth, whoever it was, is planting these seeds throughout the story to send this message. God is doing something in the lives of these two women and in the life of this man, that these three characters are intertwined and it's moving towards something. That with the benefit of hindsight, we know this entire story is a picture of God's incredible love for us, the love he gives to us in our impossible place. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Time passes after the end of chapter 2. Months go by. Ruth works her way through the barley harvest, then the wheat harvest, and then it's summer. It's a little bit of a critical moment in the story because there's no longer anywhere to glean. The harvests are over. How are these women going to take care of themselves now in the coming months? And something begins to change with Naomi. She has started to transform from the devastated woman we met in chapter 1 to someone who's ready to face the world again. And the timing is critical, right? Because their need is about to become really apparent again as these harvest seasons end and there's nowhere for Ruth to glean. After so many months of Ruth caring for her, Naomi decides it's time for her to be proactive in helping Ruth find a husband. More specifically, she wants Boaz to marry Ruth. She's like, this is the guy. I've decided it. Which is not surprising to us, right? Many of us already know the end of the story. Ruth is one of the most popular books in the Bible. And we look at how the author plants seeds of this is where the destination of the story is going. So it makes sense to us. It's like, of course. Like any good love story, it's going to end up at this point. But here's the thing. This would have been on no one's radar back then. No one would have matched Ruth with Boaz. He was wealthy. He was influential. He was an older man. The language throughout Ruth has both Naomi and Boaz calling Ruth my daughter, sending the message that they were probably the same generation. So it wouldn't have been on his radar that this young woman would have been somebody to match with. She was poor. She was a foreigner from an enemy nation. She was young, probably in her early to mid-20s. Some of you are going, wait a minute, but she was married before. The most she could have been married to her previous husband was 10 years. And that would have been if when Naomi and her husband and her sons moved to the foreign land, her sons immediately got married. Right? Realistically, it was maybe a while before they got married. And the average marrying age of women back then was around like 12 to 15 years old, which is awkward, and we're not going to dwell on that too much. But what that means is even at the, if she got married at like the oldest end, 15, and it was the second they moved there, and it's 10 years later, at the oldest, she's in her mid-20s, probably her early 20s, maybe even late teens. We don't really know. All that to say, she's young. Nobody's pairing this older man with this younger, foreign, poor woman. On every level, they were not a match. Not only that, there would have been rumors that she must be barren. After all, she had been married to Mahlon's son, to Mahlon, and not produced any children, let alone a son. On every level, she would have been marked as not the way to go. This past weekend, it's still the weekend, the last couple days, my brain doesn't always do what I want it to do. Heather and I actually took our second son to our alma mater, where we graduated from way back in 2000, Gordon College. We're doing campus visits with him because it's that time. But I want to show you a picture. I probably should have gotten Heather's approval first before I started posting pictures of us in front of everyone. We're cool? We'll find out. This is Gregory Auditorium at Gordon College. And you're all like, oh, wow, great classroom. Way back on August 28th, 1996, it was the first day of classes our freshman year. And we randomly ended up sitting next to each other right around there somewhere. And I thought, I'm immediately interested. And she informed me later that she thought, this guy's weird. I don't know what that's all about, but we did become really good friends. We actually ended up in the same friend circle for years. For our freshman, sophomore, junior year, we hung out all the time in the same circle, doing everything together, and becoming really close that way. My kids like to tease me, oh, Dad, Mom friend zoned you. Like, it worked out, okay, man? You're here. Something changed our senior year. She saw God's will. I don't know. It's always the danger when I have the mic and she doesn't. I'll hear about it later. Here's where I'm going with this, right? Like, we today tend to, when we meet couples, like, what's one of the first questions? How'd you meet? What's the story? Like, we have, and we love hearing each other's stories of how we crossed paths and how we met and then who said what first. And we aren't usually doing stuff like, so what's the socioeconomic status? Where are you from? Are these parents like we're not in it's just a different picture for how we pursue love and marriage today. Several thousand years ago, this is not how it worked at all. It was arranged, right? One commentator describing the unlikely pairing of Ruth and Boaz wrote, quote, marriages were strategic opportunities for families to forge political and social ties with other families to strengthen their standing in the community. Ruth was a woman who was socially unacceptable for Boaz on every level. It wouldn't have even occurred to people to pair them together. The fairy tale stories that we love, like Snow White meeting a Prince Charming and being swept away to the palace, would not be written for thousands of more years. That was not even on the cultural radar. Talk about love in a hopeless place. And yet, Naomi, emerging from her grief and months of care from Ruth, has an idea. Picks up in chapter 3, verse 1. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you." It actually is written, "I must find rest for you," in the original Hebrew. She's going, "I want you to have rest, to have stability, to not have to live in this fear and uncertainty of the future. I want you to have rest, like what you have given me these months." She says, "Where you will be well provided for. Now, Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight, he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know that you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." We're going to talk about this. I have some stuff to say. The bath, the perfume, the nicest clothes. Let's translate to modern day what exactly is going on, right? This is how a bride got ready for a wedding. If Naomi was telling Ruth to do this today, she would have said to her, "Hey, go get something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue, put on a white dress, get a veil, and let him do the math on what we are thinking." Right? Like, it is not subtle. It reminds me of a moment from the show Friends. Did you guys ever watch that? You may have heard of it. One of the most popular sitcoms of all time. There's an episode called The One with All the Wedding Dresses. And in it, the one character, Rachel, has been kind of dating this other guy, Joshua. She's not supposed to be with him. It's supposed to be Ross, but whatever. Wow. She... Thank you, Ryan. Rachel is like coming on too strong in this relationship. And Joshua is like, "This is getting way too serious, way too fast." So he's like, "I think we need to break up. Like, I'm not like thinking as long term as you are." And so Rachel is back in the apartment with the other two women. And she's just devastated. She's, you know, like, "Oh, you know, I'm so sad." And Phoebe goes, "I know something that might make you feel better." And for whatever reason, they all have all these wedding dresses. So the camera cuts to the next scene. The three of them are sitting there in wedding dresses watching TV. And Rachel's like, "You know what? This does feel better." And then the doorbell rings. And they're like, "Oh, no, nobody can see us like this. Chandler's supposed to come over and do blah, blah, blah." And Rachel's like, "I got it," thinking it's one of the guys. So she goes over the door, opens it up. To this moment, and as she's opening the door, she goes, "I do," and it is Joshua, the guy who thought she was like too whatever, and he sees all of this and just goes, "I gotta go," and he turns and runs, and Rachel's like, "Well, that takes care of that." There is no mistaking what someone is thinking when they're wearing a wedding dress. Right? Like, there's no accent. Like, "I don't know. Maybe they're just hanging out." Like, there's no. You are thinking about one thing. And Naomi, in these verses 3 and 4, Naomi was telling Ruth, "Look like a bride. He will get the hint. Like, it doesn't matter how dense he is going to figure this one out. Lay down by his feet, and let's get this started. Do not," she even tells her, "don't talk. Let him do the math." Now some have understood this phrase, "uncover his feet," as having some, we're mostly all adults in here. There's some kids. Some people have understood that phrase to maybe mean something else, is like, they were going a lot further than just checking out feet. And here's the thing. In Hebrew, that phrase actually does have a double meaning. It can refer to feet. It can also refer to something else. I'm trying to keep a PG-13, so I'm not going to say what it could refer to as uncovering, but it could, right? And so some people have suggested, hey, we think Ruth, like, there was a lot more going on than, you know, talking. And here's the deal. It could have been innuendo. I don't think it was in this passage. I don't think that's what's going on here, right? Because we see throughout this book, Boaz praises Ruth before and after as being a woman of integrity, a woman of virtue, a woman of honor. That Boaz is celebrated as a man of valor and integrity and strong reputation. And spoiler alert, I'm just full of spoiler alerts. He's going to reveal that there is another guy who has a more direct claim to Ruth, that he can't marry her until this other guy says, I'm not interested. And so for me, I find it very hard to believe that anything happened that would tarnish either of their virtues or that he would speak of Ruth in this way if they did something farther than when there was another man that would have potentially had a claim. So I think, and what a lot of us tend to think, is that, yeah, it could have been innuendo, but in this case, it was really just more about she's lifting up the blanket so some cold air hits his feet and he wakes up, right? Like, if any of you have had a kid crawl into bed with you or your dog hop up, like, you just kind of sense it sometimes when they knock a blanket out of there. That's what was going on that night. So, back to the story. Now that we're all on the same page of what that could mean, but what it does not, in fact, mean. Ruth agrees to the plan. She goes to the threshing floor that night, quietly uncovers Boaz's feet, lays down by them. Boaz feels the cold air, senses presence, whatever, wakes up, and Ruth immediately deviates from the plan. Just immediately. It says in verse 8, in the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. Who are you? He asked. I am your servant, Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. Ruth chooses a proactive route. She's not going to sit there and just passively be quiet and let Boaz do the math. She tells Boaz exactly what she wants. And she uses his prayer to do so. Remember back in verse 12 of chapter 2 when he said, may the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. This spread the corner of your garment could also be translated wings. She's using the same ancient Hebrew word that Boaz used before. She's going, hey, you prayed for God to take care of me? You're it, man. You're the one. Like, you're the one God's using here. That this language, spread the corner of your garment, it sounds weird to us, but that was very clearly a metaphor for them of marriage. She's going, let me be a part of your household. Let me come into your family. And then she tells him, since you are the guardian redeemer of our family. Has anyone thought it was weird that keeps coming up that Boaz is a relative of them? I mean, typically, if someone passes away, we don't say to the widow or the widower, yeah, but did he have any cute brothers? Nice uncle? Like a pretty sister? There's some other options in that family to work. Like, that isn't usually where we go to, right? But we've kind of talked about how that for women back then, this isn't right, but it's how it was, they really had no status without a man, right? They couldn't own land. They couldn't do business. There were so many things, so many doors closed to them. For many widows, what this meant is that really the only option to survive would be selling themselves. And so over time, this practice came to be called the guardian redeemer, where it was expected that if a man died who was married but had not fathered a son, who could carry on that name, who would then own the land, who could take care of the widow in the dead husband's absence, that it was then the responsibility of the closest male relative, so typically a brother, to then marry that woman and father a son through her in the name of the dead man. And then that son could carry on the family name that would have otherwise died with this husband, would then be able to have and retain the property to care for the mother and the future generations. It would stay in the family. People were not lining up to be guardian redeemers. It actually was a costly endeavor. In a culture where so much value was placed on your family and your children and providing an inheritance for your children, being a guardian redeemer came at a cost. To care for this other person, to give up some of what would be your children's inheritance for this other child to grow up and live not in your name. Right? And for this particular situation, when Naomi and her husband had left 10 years before, they had sold the rights to their family land to be used by someone else. So a family redeemer would come in and have to redeem this land as well. This would have come at great cost. Now, it'd be worth it if you weren't going to be able to produce any sons and you could keep it, and now you've expanded the wealth of your children going forward. But if you produce a son, you've taken away from your children by using resources to redeem this other family. Well, Ruth is being really explicit in what she's saying. She's going, I want you to marry me. I want you to be my guardian redeemer. Ruth is showing tremendous hesed, right? Because she is looking out for Naomi and her family name, and she is asking Boaz to sacrifice a lot, and this could have gone badly. Most men would have thrown her out or done worse. They would have said, absolutely not. I am not risking 1 cent of my children's inheritance for some enemy foreign nation's daughter. That even though the guardian redeemer was a normal expectation and practice, for some reason nobody had said anything about it in the months and months that Ruth and Naomi had been there. Because it was really easy to ignore this foreign woman and nobody was going to call them out on it. Right? So Ruth is going out on a limb. It's a risky request. Boaz responds in verse 10. And everything about his response displays the same kind of hesed that Ruth has been showing. The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. He's referring to when she gave up her life to come with Naomi. When she went and risked asking for more when she was gleaning. He's going, all of that was good hesed? And it's literally, the word there, kindness, is the Hebrew word hesed. He's going, this hesed right now is even greater. He says, you have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. He's going, you could have restarted your life. It would have been so much easier for Ruth to just start over with some other guy, forget Naomi's family name, let that be her problem, I'm going to get my safety and my future. She could have done that. But instead, she's risking so much more for the sake of this family. He goes, you could have done that, and now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of town, my town, know that you are a woman of noble character. Not only is Boaz not insulted or upset with Ruth's boldness, because she kind of is calling him out for not having already volunteered to be the guardian redeemer. Somebody in that family should have already done so in the months before. He is amazed with her loving kindness, the hesed that she uses. Ruth is a strong, virtuous woman with incredible character, and Boaz admires her for it. And in the same way that she steps out and goes beyond, he agrees to do the same. He tells her he's all in. But in the following verses, he goes, look, there's one complication. Technically, there is another man who's a closer relative and must decline the opportunity to marry Ruth and potentially acquire this land. tangible way when humans demonstrate the hesed love that God and Jesus have demonstrated for us. And I think there's a few ways that we can directly apply it to our lives. As we live out that call of now that Christ has redeemed us, we are to demonstrate hesed love to those around us, that we should reflect what has been done for us. And the first is this, that loving kindness, hesed, is intentional. It doesn't just happen, right? We can't just hope that, like, I'm going to be a good person, and then I will just kind of naturally display some loving kindness. Ruth does not sit idly by in this story, does she? She initiates. She takes action. She is intentional at every step of the way, whether it's not leaving Naomi, whether it's caring for Naomi, whether it's proposing to Boaz. She initiates. In Matthew 5:41, Jesus, talking about the kind of love we're supposed to have for people, says, if a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it 2 miles. There's this fascinating passage where back then the Roman guards who had occupied and conquered the Jews could make anyone carry their gear for a mile. And so it takes someone essentially 2 miles out of their day. You had to drop what you're doing, pick it up, and go. It was insulting. It was offensive for the Jewish people. Here they are, they're not only conquered, now they have to carry the tools of the soldiers that have done this to them. And Jesus says to them, go 2 miles. You don't get any credit for doing something that's required of you, right? Like, that's not demonstrating loving kindness if you do the minimum. Jesus is going, you need to go beyond. Go beyond what the culture expects. Go beyond what you need. Ruth could have gone home with her family, and that would have been a good decision. But she went beyond and chose something better by staying with Naomi. Ruth could have simply gleaned, but she went beyond and asked for something more. Boaz could have just simply taken care of them, but he goes beyond and does something more to care for, to go after the spirit of what the scriptures were saying, not just what the letter of it said. We are called to go beyond, and that takes intentionality. That requires initiative of us seeing opportunities and then being proactive, even when there is tremendous risk. Maybe to our career, maybe to our relationships, maybe to our standing in the community or in our school or wherever it is we are, that taking initiative can come with risk. But it's what God calls us to. That loving kindness is patient. It's easy for us when we read, you could read the entire book of Ruth in a few minutes. It's just 4 chapters. And it's easy to lose sight that this is a story that spans years. That Ruth doesn't meet Boaz and propose the next day. There's months and months and months of hard work and harvesting and gleaning where there's no indication that anything's going to happen. That Ruth, she doesn't know the end of the story the way that we do, but she has this patience that her loving kindness stays consistent in spite of everything pointing to it being hopeless. Right? That when we display loving kindness, it takes patience. It's easy to be patient sometimes with in situations where it's simple or we like the person and they're being agreeable, but sometimes loving kindness, it requires us to be patient in difficult situations, where it's not going how we want, where it's with people who are difficult, or there doesn't seem to be any hope. 1 Corinthians 13:4 says, love is patient and kind. Who is someone that you need to be patient with? We probably all have somebody that pops into our mind. That God is calling us to show loving kindness to. It might be a spouse, it might be a child, it might be a coworker, it might be another student, it might be another person on the team or the club or the association we're with, but somewhere God is calling us to show this loving kindness through patience with someone. And finally, loving kindness sacrifices. Boaz sacrifices for Ruth and Naomi over and over. He gives of his harvest, he provides resources, he commits to marriage, which we'll see next week, comes at cost to himself. Ruth sacrifices over and over for Naomi. In James 1:27, The author writes, pure and genuine religion in the sight of God the Father means caring for orphans and widows in their distress and refusing to let the world corrupt you. When James wrote this, what he was saying to them, what he was trying to get them to understand is true sacrifice, true love, is when you do something for someone where nothing is expected back, right? There is nothing the widows and orphans could ever do to return what was being given to them in that culture and in that time. Now, James is kind of going like, do you really think it counts when your acts of love can be reciprocated, when there's a quid pro quo, where there's some way that it benefits you, it moves you up in the company, it moves you forward in the relationship, it gives you some sort of advantage. He's going, man, true love is when they can do nothing to advance you, nothing to repay you, nothing to help you out, nothing whatsoever, and you still sacrifice for them. That's hesed. That is going above and beyond what is required or expected. Boaz demonstrates Christ's love when he sacrifices for these two widows. There's nothing they can do for him. And there's every reason in the culture he could ignore this cost to himself. There's no way this pays off for him in the world's eyes. But in God's economy, Boaz's hesed, his loving kindness, has incredible eternal value. It lands them in the ancestry of Christ. It's a picture of what God does for us. So where do we need to demonstrate loving kindness? As we look at the story, as we read these examples, where is God asking you to show loving kindness? Who is he asking you to show loving kindness to? Ask God to show you where you can grow in your intentionality, in your patience, and in where you can sacrifice for his glory. As we prepare to celebrate communion, that ultimate moment where Jesus was our guardian redeemer, would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for this story of Ruth and Boaz and Naomi and all that you demonstrate through it. And God, we thank you for sending Jesus to be our guardian redeemer. We thank you for the incredible hesed that this represents in you and in Christ, and we ask that as we take this time, that you would honor it, that you would guide us as we remember and thank you for it. In your name, amen.